Thanks to all of you for coming here today, and thanks for letting me present over this topic. I know that the speaker after me will also speak about steroid hormones and environment with respect to the leaching potential. So what I've decided was to first give you a broad overview, and then especially talk about one way by which the degradation of steroid hormones can happen in natural environments. So let's see how this works. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge, to make sure I get to the acknowledgement, since we have a lot of slides here. Robert Young and Jenny Jones from my lab have done the majority of this work. Yunya Yang is working on the biodegradation side of this work that I will not have time to present today. Jessica Davis, professor in my department, is the co-PI. James Gray from the USGS is helping us a lot with the tandems mass spectrometry. And of course, thanks to all the funding sources. So why study steroid hormones? Well, these chemicals belong to a class of emerging contaminants that have received a lot of focus recently and are known as endocrine disruptors. These compounds can, at very, very low concentrations, influence the endocrine system by impacting development of knowledge, causing sexual disruption, as I will show you a few examples on, and cause cancers. A very big and a very well-cited study that came out of USGS a few years ago showed that we found steroid hormones more or less in all the small rivers around in the United States, and most of the concentrations were in the range 9 to 116 nanograms per liter. These very low concentrations, of course, makes it extremely difficult to analyze these chemicals in natural matrices. I'll focus on the three hormones that you see down here, the androgen, testosterone, the male, primary male hormone, progesterone, which is often referred to as the pregnancy hormone, since that's the hormone that is being produced significantly when you get pregnant to prevent the baby from being, to make sure that the baby stays inside you. 17-beta-estradiol is, of course, the female hormone. So what's the real problem with all these endocrine disruptors and these low concentrations? Well, first of all, a lot of studies have now showed that depending on the type of hormone, it can lead to masculinization or feminization in amphibia, such as fish, frogs, alligators, and even polar bears. It can result in deformation of the sexual reproductive organs, and it can also lead to a potential increase maybe in testicular and breast cancers. The example I'm giving down here is basically that you have two fathead minnows. This is a typical male, and you see all these tubercles on the nose. And here you have a female. If you expose that female here to a little bit of methyl testosterone, you can see how she creates or develops male characteristics, indicating that she's transferring from a female to a male, which was even better illustrated in a recent study that came out of the USGS group that I work with, based on a study in the Boulder Creek. What they did here was that they measured the impact of wastewater from a wastewater treatment plant on fish characteristics. And basically they measured the ratio between male and female upstream of a wastewater treatment facility, as well as downstream of a wastewater treatment facility. And what they found was that there was a skewed ratio between females and males downstream in this river. There was actually 4 females for every male in the system. Furthermore, they also found that downstream for the wastewater treatment facility, there was a skewed ratio between intersex and female or male fish. Actually, as you can see here, this is a typical example on an intersex fish that both have male reproductive organs and female organs inside it. So, of course, if we change the ecology in a way that suddenly we only have female fish in a river, there will be no more fish reproduction. You take out the fish of a river, it can actually result in a total collapse of the ecosystem. So, potential sources, there are many. I don't have time to talk about all of them, but some of the major sources are all the confined animal feeding operations due to just natural excretion of hormones. but also due to the fact that we often use steroid hormones for enhanced growth. Another major source is the wastewater treatment plants. All what we pee and poo out, you know, go through these wastewater treatment plants. And most of it goes straight through the wastewater treatment plant because they're not optimized for removing these types of compounds. We use a lot of synthetic hormones such as ethanol, estradiol in birth control pills, which is very resistant. We use a lot of hormones in hormone treatments. At the hospitals, most of this is flushed out in the sink and goes straight through the river or the wastewater treatment plant. Some of these numbers down here illustrate mean concentrations of estrogens and androgens in biosolids, which is also a waste product from the wastewater treatment process. So, with that little introduction, we then started thinking about, okay, what are the major processes by which these steroid hormones can be removed, or what are the processes that influence the fate of these hormones in natural systems? One of the obvious things is the fact that these very nonpolar compounds indeed does sorb to the soil in soil and sediments. Some studies have shown that estradiol seems to sorb to a high extent of testosterone, probably due to the aromaticity in estrogen, in contrast to testosterone, which does not have a pi electron system. Also, biodegradation seems to be faster for testosterone than estradiol, which is typically observed for compounds that doesn't have an aromatic electron configuration. But what I will be talking about today is the potential impact of natural sunlight on the fate of testosterone, estradiol, and progesterone. Because very little or no information actually exists on the photodegradation of steroid hormones by environmentally relevant light, such as the light in the UVA range. There are some work out there on UVC, the impact of UVC light on these compounds, especially with respect to using UVC for engineering solutions. So, the conditions that are relevant for natural, or why UVA is relevant perhaps, is the fact that 99% of all the sunlight that is received on Earth is in the range that covers the UVA range, namely from 320 to 400 nanometer. I'll be talking about two different phenomena, direct versus indirect photolysis. The direct photolysis is basically direct reaction arising from the absorption of UVA light by steroid hormones and thereby conversion of these compounds into metabolites due to intermolecular rearrangements, reductions, oxidations, and so forth. The other thing I'll be referring to is indirect photolysis, which is basically reactions with other molecules that we refer to as photosynthesizers that are made reactive by the absorption of UV light. By the reaction of UV light, for example, dissolved organic matter or nitrate can form very reactive radicals or excited states that can then go in and react with the steroid hormones and cause the transformation of these compounds. So the objective was first of all to determine the potential for photolysis of estradiol, testosterone, and progesterone with UVA light. Then elucidate the impact of nitrate as a potential photosynthesizer and dissolved organic matter. Here in this case we use humic acid and the photolysis of these three steroid hormones. Finally, we also wanted to try to do photolysis in a real river system. So we did the same photolysis study in the Savannah River water. And then I will try to establish some kinetic rate constants and compare the observations that we got in these systems. The experimental setup to investigate the impact was basically we had triplicate samples. We added one high concentration, 1 milligram per liter of hormone into small borosilica quartz tubes. We then had two systems, one with just DI water and one in a phosphate buffer. And these two systems were to make sure that we could indicate whether or not direct photolysis would happen. Then we looked at the impact of nitrate as a potential photosynthesizer, humic acid, and nitrate plus humic acid to see if it could cause any form of indirect photolysis as well. Detection was done by HPLC and some tandem mass spectrometry. The chemical reactor that we used was a simple setup, as you see here. Basically, we put down all our samples here. We expose them to light sources that only basically gives us a kind of a quasi monochromatic light distribution here with a max at about 368 nanometer. Then all the samples are going to go around. So we make sure that they all get the same amount of light exposure. And then we basically just take samples out as a function of time. The first study that I'm showing you here is basically the impact of autolysis on the organic compound progesterone. And as you can see here, we have the dark control up here, and we have all the different treatments here. And basically what you see is that no matter what type of treatment or what type of aqueous composition you had in these systems, we basically saw the same degradation kinetics, clearly indicating that in these systems we only have direct photolysis of progesterone. On the other hand, and this is interesting because often people, they kind of just lump all these steroid hormones together and say, oh, they might behave very, very similarly, right, with respect to degradation, sorption, all this, but they are actually a little bit different. If you see here, for 17-beta-estradiol, we have two reduced functional groups, whereby on the progesterone that I showed you before, we have two oxidized functional groups there. And the importance of that, and also the fact that we have an aromatic ring here, and that we don't have aromaticity in testosterone and progesterone, will indeed change the chemical properties of these compounds significantly. And you see here, to our big surprise, when we look at photolysis of estradiol, we saw no direct photolysis at all for estradiol. However, when we add in a little bit of humic acid, we suddenly see a very, very rapid degradation of 17-beta-estradiol, indicating that the formation of organic radicals, or perhaps excited states in organic matter, is capable of then going in and react with these, react with estradiol and convert it into various metabolites. The last one is testosterone here, and you see that behaves somehow in between progesterone and 17-beta-estradiol, because with testosterone we see both direct photolysis, and again when we add in a little bit of humic acid, we also see that there is indirect photolysis taking place in these systems. Testosterone has both an oxidized functional group and a reduced functional group, indicating that it also has intermediate behavior between progesterone and estradiol. I can see I have to hurry up, huh? All right, so if you look at the kinetics data here, basically what we see here for testosterone, if you look at the half-life, indirect photolysis was happening with about a 50 days half-life. When you add humic acid in, you cut the half-life in half about, so you end up with 20 days half-life. Progesterone had about 80 days half-life under these conditions, no matter whether you had indirect or direct conditions. 17-beta-estradiol, only indirect photolysis was observed, and it went very rapidly. To further investigate the impact of humic acid on these systems, I'm here plotting basically the first order rate constant for the degradation of testosterone in the presence of humic acid as a function of humic acid concentration. And you see here, we actually accelerate the degradation of testosterone all the way up to a concentration of about 50 milligrams per liter of humic acid, after which it kind of decrease a little bit, because what can happen at a certain point of time is that the humic acid actually takes up all the sunlight and doesn't necessarily give up all its capacity to testosterone. Here is an example where we did the same study, but just in the Savannah River water, so very rich in organic matter, 60 milligrams of carbon per liter, pH 6.5, filtered through a 0.2 micron filter. Again, here I'm illustrating that in a real river water, we can see photolysis of testosterone, and we even saw that it was about 16% faster than pure DI water. So conclusions, since I can see that Jim is moving closer and closer to me. What we found this study was that indeed direct photolysis was observed for testosterone and progesterone, but not from 17-beta-estradiol. Indirect photolysis was observed for 17-beta-estradiol and testosterone in the presence of humic acid. humic acid concentration accelerated the photolysis of testosterone all the way up to a concentration of about 50 milligrams per liter. And we did indeed see that when we take a real river water rich in organic matter, that we could also cause the photolytic transformation of these compounds. So current studies is, of course, to figure out what type of metabolites was formed in these systems, and they are right now running on the GC10 of mass spec. I was not able to get that, and also we have a big element, big effort in my lab where we're investigating degradation, biodegradation of these steroid hormones with manure-borne bacteria and pure cultures such as E. coli and Mycobacterium. So with that, thank you very much for your attention, and hopefully I didn't go over too much.